This is 4:55 on Friday, August 26th. All right, speed of light of electrical signals in guided medium, that is fiber, wire, the like, is the speed faster, the same, or slower than in free space? This is physics 202, right? We've all seen something like this. So it's the law, right? That's the fastest you can go. And so indeed in guided media, and even in air, for example, the speed of light is in fact slower than it is in free space. And how much slower is often expressed in a term called the velocity factor of the medium. And so the velocity factor for coaxial cable is about 0.8 or so. Fiber is a little higher. But, you know, the free space speed of light is the limit. That's it. That's the fastest you can go. And everything else is slower. So now let me ask you the next question. Why do we care in a networking class about the speed of light? And this is a fill-in-the-blank question, I think, right? Okay, that's everybody more or less done. So Lots of good answers. So let's say some of them out loud. Networking signals are electrical signals, right? That's how they start out inside computers. They can be turned into light using a light-emitting diode, say, and piped down a fiber. They can be turned into radio waves using a radio transmitter. Or they can just be set as electrical signals on a wire, a transmission line between two different points. And the point of getting to talking about the speed of light is that that's sort of the limit of how long it will take to send a signal from, or that governs how long it will take to send a signal from one point to another, right? And so, you know, if I start sending a bit at a particular time, it will be a certain amount of time later before that bit shows up somewhere else, sort of regardless. And so that's sort of the limit at the speed of light, and then we make it practical, that calculation, by including the velocity factor of the medium that we're using to send. Now notice that this doesn't really say anything about bandwidth, right? It just says how long it will take a signal that we start here to get to there, right? So this is a sort of speed times time calculation that says in a certain amount of time I can go a certain distance. It doesn't say anything at all about bandwidth, right? Bandwidth that we talked about last time is sort of the signaling rate that we go at. So many bits per second. And we look at that at a single point on the wire. Right? Now, both of these things are important in networking, and we're sort of evolving in these little calculations toward a more complete understanding of how long it will take to send now a message, which requires a certain number of bits, from one place to another. That's going to have a component of how long does it take to wiggle the wire for each of the bits, that's the bandwidth, and a component of how long does it take each of those bits to travel the distance that it has to go. Okay? These are the general terms. We'll get to the specific formulas later, but I wanted you to sort of tune in to the difference between bandwidth and speed of light issues. Right? Those are two different things. Okay. We will be talking more about this as time goes on. So I think we got to approximately this place last time, and we'll pick up from here. We talked last time largely about what's at the edges of the network. This time we'll talk about what's inside and go on from there. I feel like we did this. I pressed the wrong button. There we go. Network core. Yeah, Matt.
I was just curious, do you kind of expect us to know the general bandwidth for certain mediums, like LAN?
Yeah, you'll get an understanding of that over the course of when we talk about those things.
Okay.
I'm not expecting you to know them right now.
Okay.
Not a prerequisite for the class, but something that we will talk about in the course of the class. Okay. So, the network core. We talked last time about the edges. We hook in to the network, and sort of behind the covers and completely opaque to most of the people who use the internet, there's a lot going on to transfer the data from one place to the other. And there are two fundamental approaches to transferring data from one place to another that go by the name of circuit switching and packet switching. In circuit switching, the idea is that we create either an actual electrical circuit or a virtual electrical circuit between two points. And this is the way that the telephone system, as invented by Alexander Graham Bell 130 years ago now, worked. Is that when you picked up the telephone in an Alexander Graham Bell telephone system, what you got was an electrical circuit from your handset to the handset of the other person. Okay? So what does that mean? It means that the wires involved in that circuit are dedicated completely to the carrying of your conversation. So that's the idea of a circuit. And so in order to accomplish that circuit switching, what happened in Alexander Graham Bell's day was that there were telephone operators who actually moved plugs around on a so-called switchboard in order to complete that circuit. And then they did it with relays, and then they did it with transistors, and then they realized that they didn't really have to do that at all. That you didn't have to have a circuit between the different places, that you could instead turn voice signals into data and send the data around in a network that where the circuits were more or less permanently, the electrical circuits and the optical circuits were permanently established. And so that leads us to the idea of packet switching. And the telephone system was actually late to come to packet switching. Data networking, Ethernet and other kinds of wide area networks happened much earlier than the telephone system moving to that world. But in the you know, today's cellular world, the voice over IP world, convergence is happening. Everything is data, and pretty much everything happens by packet switching at the end-to-end level, while the circuit switching, the electrical circuits have to exist, are more or less permanently established and just used in the course of the packet switching. Right. Okay, so pictures of that whole story. The main point about all this is that when you use circuit switching, the resources needed for the session, whether it's a phone call or the data session, are reserved at the time that the session is established. And as a result, because they're reserved, you have a pretty good quality of connection in terms of always being able to send data, always being able to receive data. But those resources are reserved for the connection. So the other problem with this scheme is that you go through this setup phase in which that circuit is established. And if you think about it, you know, think about a call between your home and London in England, say. In the early days, what you had to do was you had to call up the operator and say, I want to make a call to London. And, you know, maybe a half hour later, all the operators have plugged together all the circuits to make that work. And then you can start to talk, right? Now, that's been speeded up these days by the automated switching. And you can establish that circuit much faster in human terms. But think about what would happen if every time you wanted to send, you wanted to browse a web page in Europe, the thing that first had to happen was you had to set up a circuit to that web page, to the web server. Instead, we're using these days packet switching. Where'd it go? Packet switching. Packet switching, we divide up the data itself into little chunks, and the network's job is to just deliver the chunks wherever they want to go. So I put a chunk of data in, the network core delivers it to where it wants to go. There's no setup associated with it, it just it just sort of magically goes there. Part of the point of this class is to take the magic out of that process. How does data injected here in Pullman end up in London reliably time after time? So there's a lot of sharing now going on, because I send a packet over a link, you send a packet over a link, right? That link is not dedicated to either of us, except while our individual packets are being sent. So we use the resources as needed. That means that it's possible for there to be more demand for the resources than there are resources. And that causes problems. You may have thought I was sort of beating on circuit switching when I was saying all the problems with it. Well, no, there are problems with circuit switching. There are problems with packet switching as well. And in fact, what happens with packet switching is that when there is too much demand, the resources available, you get what's called congestion, and that means that packets have to wait in line, right? Somebody else's packets have to be transmitted before our packets get transmitted. We incur a delay associated with that. That's called queuing delay. Or the other thing that happens is that if there's too much demand for the resources, some packets just have to get lost in the network. They don't ever show up at the destination. So, again, for data networking, computer communication networking, this is going to be something that we have to study, is how does congestion work? What happens when packets get delayed? What happens when packets get dropped? How do the end systems respond to those things in order to lessen the congestion, right? If a bunch of us are all trying to use a resource and it's oversubscribed, then what will happen to all of us is that we'll get very bad service, right? The best way for us to cope with that is to cooperatively lessen our demand. Then at least we'll know what we're going to get, or have a more reasonable expectation about what we're going to get, and we'll get it. Right? So that's a large part of what we'll talk about in various parts of this class. This is kind of a minor point, is that if you think about circuit switching, if I send a bit down the circuit, right, and then I send the next bit down the circuit, as it goes through the various parts of that circuit, it's sort of just going continuously. It never really assembles itself again anywhere else. Packet switching networks are often called store and forward networks, because as each hop along the way transmits the packet, it gets reassembled as a whole unit at the intermediate points before we start sending it onward again. That is just kind of a... Okay. We did that. So I want to go back to circuit switching now. So let's think a little bit more about circuit switching. We've got these very high bandwidth availability resources now, like fiber optic cables, which have bandwidths in excess of a gigabit per second. And suppose I want to make a phone call. It would be really silly for the phone company to give me a whole fiber to make my phone call over, right? Although that's sort of the model that circuit switching implies. So in order to sort of more reasonably use the resources, even in circuit switching, we want to have techniques for dividing up resources and giving everybody a fraction of the resources. And there are a couple of common techniques for doing that. called frequency division multiplexing and time division multiplexing. Multiplexing is just a word that means sharing, really. It says multiple users of the same resource, but in a very controlled way. So frequency division multiplexing says, and this is, to me, this is easier to understand when we talk about optics and fibers and the like, which says that, you know, visually and physics-wise, we could tell colors apart, right? So if I take an optical fiber and I send multiple different colors of light down that fiber, at the other end, there'll still be those multiple different colors. And if I sort of have some scheme for modulating each of the colors, I can tell what's going on each of the colors. That's frequency division multiplexing. Another example of frequency division multiplexing is, suppose we were all... I won't use that example, I'll use a different example. Suppose you go to a concert and there are multiple people singing, but they're singing on different pitches. You can tell what each of them is saying, to a certain extent. I mean, there's a lot of interference going on, but to a certain extent you can tell what each of them is saying because they're singing on different pitches. They're all singing on the same pitch, it gets harder to understand. Okay, that's frequency division multiplexing. It's a way of sharing the available resources among multiple different signals. Another way is time division multiplexing, TDM, in which I talk for a little bit of time, then you talk for a period of time, then he talks for a period of time, and then I talk again. Okay? So in a planned way, we cycle through different people talking, and that's illustrated here. Yeah?
But they're all on the same frequency.
But they're all on the same frequency in that case. And then, of course, you can combine the two. Right?
Would TDM take a performance hit as opposed to FDM, or since they're using the entire frequency to send light through, they can get more information?
Since they're using the entire frequency, they can send... You know, this is a property that you can study in signals and systems in EEE, right? That if you have more available spectrum, you can send faster. Yeah. Okay. So it works both ways. Okay. So packet switching now is, in essence, a different kind of multiplexing. It's a statistical time division multiplexing scheme in which we try to send when the medium is free. And so if it's free, it'll send my packet, and if it's not free, my packet has to wait. That's another kind of multiplexing, really. But it turns out that it has worked very well for data networking ever since it was sort of discovered. there are other multiplexing schemes that we'll talk about, I think, when we talk about wireless, that have to do with things called code division multiplexing and other things that, again, are all different ways of sharing a single medium among multiple different signals. So the claim is packet switching allows more users to use the network. This is a bit of a lie, actually, but it's a useful lie. And it has to do with the fact that it's very rare for for a user to a user of a circuit switched system to use the full reserved bandwidth. That's really where we're winning with packet switching. So here's the example. We have a 1 megabit per second link. Now remember, that's a bandwidth. That's not a latency. That's not doesn't say anything about how long it takes something to get from one end to the other. But 1 megabit per second, that's the signaling rate. Each user uses 10 kilobits per second when active, but is only active 10% of the time on a more or less random basis. So we could reserve 10 kilobits per second for each of those users, but that wouldn't necessarily work very well because they're not, that's only on average. And sometimes they want to go faster and sometimes they're idle. So in a circuit switching scheme, if you wanted to provide them the 10 kilobit per second burst rate, you'd have to reserve, you could only support 10 users. But in packet switching, you might think you could support 100 users, but somewhere between 35 and 100, you'll find that the performance falls off. Because as more of them try to use it at the same time, as there are more users, there will be more chance that more of them will want to use it at the same time, and there will be periods when it doesn't work so well, and periods when it does. But if you work out the calculations with 35 users, it's extremely rare that there would be a moment when more than 10 of them would be active. Right? And if fewer than 10 of them are active, we're not even using all the available bandwidth. Okay? So this is sort of the story of why packet switching is good. But remember, it is all predicated on the idea that users are sometimes active and sometimes not. Right? And that pattern is not predictable. If the pattern is predictable, then we can use a more defined scheme like TDM or FDM. The other thing that happens, of course, is that because the packet switching network doesn't have any setup phase, the network never really learns what the users are intending to do with the network. It just has to figure it out from the available traffic, and so you run into situations like we talked about where congestion occurs, which leads to extra delay and loss. Nevertheless, notice that today, 2011, which is only, does anybody have the book? I think the book is like 2010, but it was really written in 2000 and has just been revised. Today, we're doing audio and video over the internet, a packet switch network, all the time, always competing and doing pretty well, right? We can watch movies at home, not just clips, but whole movies successfully. We can do audio over the network to the level that we're willing to put our phone traffic on it, of a whole institution. Okay, so a lot of these problems have indeed been worked out, not to the degree that we might hope. There's still open questions there, but as a practical matter, even audio and video is working pretty well these days on the internet, and partly that's because we have put enough capacity into the backbone that we don't actually have to solve the problem very well in order to have it work. One of the characteristics of the internet is that often the easiest solution is build more bandwidth, and the technology curves associated with fiber optics and electronics have been such that building more bandwidth just gets cheaper and cheaper, and the hard problems actually do pretty much go unsolved. Okay, a few thoughts about the structure of that big center of the internet. At the center are the big internet service providers. This is Sprint and AT&T and a number of others that you usually don't even hear about because they don't interact with individual customers or even large companies. Their job is to deliver data between each other at high speeds. They're all hooked together. And they have big, big national networks. This is Sprint. It's fiber optics, multiple fiber optic cables between locations. In some places, I guess where they have the square boxes here, the Tier 1 ISPs have peering with each other. That means they interconnect their networks at those locations. And then they also have points where they connect to their more regional provider customers. The Tier 2 ISPs. I would say probably things like Frontier DSL is a Tier 2 ISP. Time Warner Cable is a Tier 2 ISP. They don't do the big the national backbones, but they're very substantial operations in their own right and serve large numbers of customers. And then those companies, Frontier and Time Warner Cable, also have local ISP. Tier 3 and local ISP roles, as well as then smaller companies like in this area, First Step and Cactus, very definitely local companies that provide internet service as well. So it's a network of networks, and the whole amazing thing is that because of the internet standards about what traffic looks like, and because of the internet standards about how you describe this location in traffic sent from that location, all of these networks are able to figure out what they're supposed to do with each individual packet, which happens at the rate of billions of times per second. Not at any one location, but across the whole great big picture. So, that's the thing we gotta figure out in the rest of this class, is how does all that work? How do we make that happen? What do the individual... We'll be looking at sort of what it looks like at the ends, right? And you'll be programming endpoints. You'll be actually programming endpoints to do some of the kinds of work that goes on in the middle, in the routing project. And then we'll be talking to a certain extent about how these links behave. As a building block, although we don't really get to build any of those, which is too bad, but, you know, there's only so much you can do. Yeah?
When it comes to the Tier 1 ISPs as really, really huge bandwidth switches and whatnot that they have, is most of that routed with just ASICs, or is there actually, like, a fair amount of processing that goes on at the same time, or...
It's mostly done with the term ASIC stands for Application Specific Integrated Circuit, right? And so it's mostly done sort of at that very low level, and the general purpose computing is used also, you know, very intensively in that to configure those lower level switches. Okay? So both things are going on. You really try to keep the individual packets away from the general purpose computers.
Yeah, I imagine
that. Yeah. Yeah. That's actually very important because there's actually very little that has to be done to a packet to move it from one place to another, and a computer is just not a very good model for doing that little bit of thing. Yeah.
If the level one ISPs, do they pay like the US government to have access to the backbone and whatnot?
No. Other way around. Other way around. The government pays them to have access to the backbone. They put in the backbone. They dig the trenches. They pay
the underwater cables. Who owns those?
The companies, not the government. They pay the government for the right to dig trenches down the middle of the street to put in the cables and so forth. But no, the government doesn't own.
Not in the U.S.
In other places, yes. Although even in other places, a lot of that has sort of moved away from the government. Places it used to be. All right, let's do a few. More technical things now. Okay, so we said that if there was too much traffic in a packet switch network, and it's a store and forward network, remember, so packets get reassembled at each hop. If there's too much traffic for a link, we have to build a waiting list of packets wanting to go over that link. So there's some sort of fairly standardized graphical notation. It's not standardized, it's sort of conventional, that says we've got a bunch of traffic waiting to go over a link. We've got at any given time one packet going over that link. If we're doing multiplexing, we just sort of rebuild the picture. So let's just look at one link between two points. We've got one packet that's being sent over the link, and the first question is, how long does it take to transmit that packet? What does it depend on? No, that's how long it takes to get here. But how long does it take here? How long does this place have to work on that? What are the factors? What are the components?
How many other packets are in the queue?
No, we're just looking at this one. This one right here. So it's already come out of the queue. Ryan.
CPU speed?
No. Okay, so the bandwidth, which is how fast we can wiggle the bits. That's one component. What's the other component?
The length of the packet.
The length of the packet, right? So this is just to wiggle the bits for this packet, I go at a certain wiggling rate, and there are a certain number of bits to do, and that's how long it takes. Okay? So that's the transmission time. All right? Now, a packet that's in this queue, how long does it have to wait before it gets its chance to start having its bits wiggled onto the wire? The sum of the times for everything in front of it, right? That's the queuing time for that packet. And that's variable, right? That's statistical. That's the statistical multiplexing idea. The number of things in the queue is going to vary as the traffic varies. But the transmission time only varies with the length of the packet, and usually the bandwidth here of the link is a constant for any given link, right? So that's the variability of the transmission time, is just the length of the packet. The queuing time is the length of the queue, or governed by the length of the queue and the bandwidth. All right. How long before this packet then is usable at the, well, let me ask that in a slightly different way. When does this packet become completely delivered at this end? When the last bit arrives, okay? Now, how long is that going to take from the time that we started sending that packet?
Transmission delay plus propagation delay plus another transmission delay? Well, assuming that. Yeah. Right?
No, just one transmission delay. Right? Because we start sending it, and at some time later, we will, and that time is the transmission delay, we will send the last bit. And then we have to wait for the last bit to arrive here, and when it gets here, then we're done. It's here. Okay? So, three components are then the transmission delay, the latency, which is governed by the speed of light in this medium, usually. We don't send too many things acoustically or anything like that. And then we're also interested in, well, how long did it take from the time it was ready here? Okay? So that also includes the queuing delay. And now we can throw in the computation delay as well. There was some computation perhaps associated with figuring out when the packet arrived here which queue it should get into. And maybe some associated with the queue itself. But okay? So those are the four pieces. And next time, we will sort of put those all together in a formula and talk about that. Now, one thing that I did that I didn't tell you about, guys, was I put an assignment on the web page on Wednesday. And I have it set here to be due on Wednesday, but since I didn't tell you about it, let's make it Friday instead. I'll change it. Okay? And it's a sequence of problems from the textbook. Not hard. I do want you please to type them. Please don't hand me handwritten things in faint pencil in unreadable handwriting. Type them. It's not that hard. If you need to make pictures, you can hand draw them. I don't insist on computer drawn pictures, but typing anyway. Questions?
No.
No, I want them on paper. I need this one on paper, because if you email them to me, then I have to print them. And
so if you don't want us to turn them in through the system online?
No, these will not be turned in through the system online.
With all the problem sets pretty much?
Yeah, for problem sets, this will... Yeah, for the programs, we'll turn them in online, but the problem sets will generally be turned in this way. Okay, any questions? One thing... If you still have your computers out, don't get them out if you don't. But if you still do have them out, if you would click on one of these links about the overall value of this lecture, and how it was it review, was it new, was it boring, were you lost, I'd appreciate it. Help me next time. Okay, so... With that, we're done. Have a great weekend.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the next one.